Well, good morning or good afternoon or good evening. I don't know when you're watching this, but I feel honored and privileged to be able to share some thoughts with you, some threads of thoughts anyways. Probably tie them in some knots, and then I'll try to unravel them too for you, or with you. As always, the place to begin is by admitting that I would rather not have this task now that I've accepted it and it's in front of me. I kind of feel like let this cup pass, so forgive me. I'm reminded of the story of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, a new movie version of which I watched over Christmas. Sir Gawain, of King Arthur's Round Table, accepts a dreadful task, but its completion is a year off, so he has plenty of time to prepare. If you don't remember the story, the main points are these. On Christmas Eve, the knights are gathered in Camelot with King Arthur. The Green Knight, unknown and uninvited, interrupts the feast and asks if there is anyone brave enough to trade strokes with his battle axe. Young foolish Gawain accepts and cuts off the head of the Green Knight. The Green Knight immediately jumps up, gathers his head, and commands Gawain to meet him a year and a day later at the Green Chapel, where Gawain will receive the same stroke which he has given. That's a really dreadful task. So back in December, when Anna asked me to take on this far less dreadful task, Epiphany seemed a long way off, and I felt like I had plenty of time to generate thoughts and materials around Jeremiah 17:5-10. This passage sparked my attention as I read through it for the first time. In fact, I chuckled to myself in a grim sort of way. Those who trust in human abilities are like a stunted plant in a wasteland. Those who trust in God are like a tree in fertile land. Who of us, myself included, isn't guilty of putting more trust in our own abilities than in God? For me, as I thought about the Jeremiah text, the grim chuckle has more to do with the creeping unease and malaise that has been slowly occupying me. I can't say exactly when I began to pay attention to this feeling. That is, when I began to feel some discomfort, probably several years ago. But it wasn't more than a mosquito bite at that point. Over the past year, however, it's grown to a chorus of mosquitoes and bites, and some yellow jacket stings occasionally, maybe some spider and tick bites as well. I feel uncomfortable in my skin. I feel weakened and preoccupied, tired, restless, uncertain, unconfident, pained, listless, humorless, dull. Sometimes I'm upset and irrational. It takes far more energy now than it ever used to interact with my friends and my loved ones even, people who I love deeply. I wake up in the morning looking forward to the end of the day. I can't wait to sleep in on the weekend. But even then, I don't sleep well. I don't wake up feeling well rested and ready for the day. I lack energy and inspiration and passion. Two Wednesdays ago, as the snow was covering everything, I came home from work, put on my snowsuit, and hiked out into the woods behind our house. I laid down. I let the snow fall on me, fall on my face. I closed my eyes and felt the cold tucking in around me. I wondered if I could just stay there. I feel shut in and shut down. Feel like a withered plant in a desolate wasteland. Some of you will no doubt recognize the signs and symptoms of depression. When I began talking with a therapist last November, mild depression was certainly a diagnosis. What would severe depression feel like, I wonder, and tremble? With my therapist's suggestion, we were working to treat it without drugs. This, of course, assumes that my depression is centered in my emotional health. I want to believe that this is true, but it means, then, that there is hard work, hard therapy, to uncover and reconnect the source of my discomfort. I have to engage deliberately, even as I don't feel much energy or inspiration. I have to ask hard questions and give hard answers. But now I've lived long enough to have gone through hard moments in life, more than once. I'm not going to recount those for you. No one really wants to hear my list of grievances. My point is that, like all living things, I've had to reassess, learn, try a new path, grow in a different direction at various moments. I've been able to do that. This is something I know I'm capable of, especially with support from loved ones, community, faith, God. I have memory and emotional muscle memory of what it takes to bounce back from difficulty. For instance, I know that adaptation doesn't happen all at once. It takes patience and intuition and reassessing what is important. One of the things that is unusual and disconcerting to me about the wasteland I find myself in right now is that there is no singular or precipitous event that put me here. No one has died. There is no divorce. There's been no grievous injury to my body or my heart. I wasn't fired. It's like I wandered into the desert all on my own and got lost without really realizing it. Maybe like Jeremiah suggests, I was too confident in my own pathfinding abilities and didn't notice the nudges that might have sent me in a different direction. If that's the case, I totally missed the signs, completely and utterly. While I haven't experienced a personal calamity recently, with hindsight, I can certainly see combinations of larger events that likely have bearing in my depression. The pandemic, fragile, intense politics, particularly around race, the building momentum and consequences of climate change, the change in my job from the narrower focus of forester to the larger responsibility of environmental resilience. Add to those the comic inevitability of my own aging, along with all my loved ones. I probably shouldn't be surprised to find the ground shifted beneath my feet, to discover I'm in unknown territory, to feel dis-ease. The depression, however, is new. It doesn't make sense to me. The lethargy that seems to surround me and drag on me, stultifying and hardening, making it increasingly difficult to be who I thought I was. This is new and unrecognizable to me. I don't believe that God tests us or abandons us to see how we'll fare or how strong our faith is. I don't feel that I've been banished or that I'm being punished or suffering the consequences of hubris, which is something of the tone in Jeremiah. Maybe the one important thing that I have to say, the big giveaway, is that my faith, such as it is, nothing terribly impressive, isn't shaken. In fact, I would say it's expanding, which is sometimes the case in wasteland experiences. And if it isn't yet expanding, then I do trust that it will. I've been reading a book which my wife Natasha gave me for Christmas called How I Became a Tree by Sumana Roy, a Bengali literature professor. It's a very personal exploration of her own deep affinity for trees. Many of you won't be surprised to hear that this interests me. One of the things I especially enjoy about her exploration is that while she acknowledges the growing science of plant and tree biology, it is not at all the primary lens she uses to understand her own desire to become a tree. Rather, she uses much more of a humanities-infused psychoanalysis to think about what trees and forests mean to her. Similar to Roy, the deeply held stories of trees is what really draws me to them. As she asks, why do the history of nations never include the history of their forests? Sumana Roy feels that trees offer medicine to her, not physical medicine for the ailments of her body, though she understands that this exists too. Her intuition is, and has been for much of her life, to hear her tell it, that trees have deeper spiritual medicine for her. There's a beckoning, a calling, an urging from trees to her, which is undeniable. And it's not simply to be near trees or among trees, but to become a tree, at least in a psychic sense. She writes, when I look back at the reasons for my disaffection with being human and my desire to become a tree, I can see that at root lay the feeling that I was being bulldozed by time. As I removed my watch from my wrist and clocks from my walls, I realized that all my flaws, and this I now discover I share with many others, came from my failure to be a good slave to time. I began envying the tree, its disobedience to human time. It was impossible to rush plants, to tell a tree to hurry up. In envy, in admiration, and with ambition, I began to call that pace tree time. I was tired of speed. I wanted to live to tree time. Slow tree time is not laziness. Who would be foolish enough to call a plant lazy? My need to become a tree, then, was a need to return to slow time. End of the quote. As I've read Roy's meditative prose, prophetic even, maybe, at least for me, and considered it against the backdrop of my own diminishment, I begin to see an alignment coming into focus. Maybe someone else with better vision or greater comprehension or deeper wisdom would have noticed much sooner. Roy is seeking trees, a respite from the too muchness of modern human life. I feel myself pruned and pared down unexpectedly and unwillingly, forced to face the limits of my being. I have to stand still, consider what is most essential, accept sustenance as it comes to me from my immediate community. Qualities of a tree. So how am I to make sense of this in light of Jeremiah's equation of the tree with God's favor? Is depression reducing me to a tree? Am I being redirected to the life which best suits me, which I have wandered away from? And then consider with me these two further lines of related thought. One is the intricate evolutionary biology of different ecosystems, where plants and animals adapt over millennia and millions of years to survive. I think about Jeremiah's bush in the wasteland, which will not see prosperity when it comes. That's verse 6. And imagine that it is in fact a plant which is wonderfully and delicately calibrated to its harsh setting, able to put life together where no tree planted by the water that sends out its roots by the stream, verse 8, ever could. True, this bush may never be as large and leafy and fruity as its distant cousin the tree, but it's performing life on a completely different level. The second line of thought is from Isaiah. God will satisfy you in a sun-scorched land, and you will be like a well-watered garden. Chapter 58, verse 11. A line which is closely repeated in Jeremiah 31, verse 12. One of the things we know is that when plants and trees are removed from the land, it begins to turn to desert. Think of the Dust Bowl. Think of parts of Africa. Another thing which we know is that when we replace plants and trees, when we do the hard work of planting them back into the desertifying landscapes, the trend can be reversed. Think of Wangari Maathai and the Greenbelt movement of Kenya, which ultimately resulted in a Nobel Peace Prize. And Sumana Roy describes a similar effort from a relatively unknown man in India, Jadhav Payang, who has continued planting for the last 32 years, she writes, in what was once a barren sandbar, a reserve which is as long as the stretch from Paris to Switzerland and has no maintenance problem because it is comfortably grown on country wisdom and practical applications, end quote. So, could it be that there is actually a place for the tree in a wasteland? Okay, so I think I have several related yet distinct ideas in play at this moment. One is the Jeremiah passage. Faithless people are like a stunted bush in the wasteland. Faithful people are like a vigorous tree in fertile land. A second idea is the careful evolution of plants and animals, which are adapted to live in harsh environments, ingenious and worthy of admiration. A third idea is the restorative and regenerative capacity of ecosystems when they are given the chance to revegetate, sometimes with human help. I want to introduce a fourth idea from Sumana Roy, one which I find quite prophetic and provocative, and then I want to try to weave these together. Sumana Roy writes, "We are intuitively aware of the difference in the temperament and teachings of forest religions versus, say, desert religions. The forest needs me as much as I need the forest. The symbiotic nature of this need took me years to comprehend." End quote. That passage hit me like a ton of bricks when I read it. I wondered, does the God who I know through Christianity, one of the so-called desert religions, need me? I mean, as in symbiotically, say the way a squirrel needs a tree and vice versa. What would that mean? Isn't that pretty straight up heresy to suggest that omnipotent God needs me and other humans as well? And what about ascribing divinity to the forest? More heresy, right? And I'm not even sure I'm comfortable with the idea that I am needed by a non-spiritualized forest either, as much as I know I need it. But And this is the part that took my breath away. Imagine the transformation of relationships, any and maybe all relationships, if I could unzipper the I-thou, object-subject, hierarchical paradigm, shed it, and step out of it, and into the vulnerability of a we, us, consensual, cooperative, and egalitarian conception of the universe that I live in. What if I, small human man, am needed by the forest as much as I need it? What if the divine needs me, my participation, my input, my help, as much as I need the divine? What if I am not separate and a problem, sinful and destructive by aberration or nature, only redeemable by miraculous grace? What if my running interior dialogue over the past couple years, I'm not in a good place, my head isn't right, I'm not feeling right, is actually, I'm in the right place. What I'm thinking and feeling is exactly right, given my setting. What if my mantra shifts to something like this? I need the soil, and the soil needs me. I need the forest, and the forest needs me. I need the ocean, and the ocean needs me. I need the sky, and the sky needs me. I need my work, and my work needs me. I need my brother, and my sister needs me. I need the people, and the people need me. I need joy, and joy needs me. I need love, and love needs me. I need the divine, and the divine needs me. There is no separation. The forest needs the microscopic mycorrhizal fungi. The ocean needs the plankton. In the same manner that each of those large systems are dependent on tiny contributors, my work is dependent on me. Joy requires my participation. My loved ones need my engagement. And the divine needs my active belief. There is no separation between these identities. They make each other whole. So here's what I think about Jeremiah and the wasteland bush. The bush is a faithful expression of the infinitely creative will to live. Finding myself stunted and in a wasteland, I believe this is true. Even though I don't yet feel the evidence, I have to believe this. If, in fact, there is no separation, if, in fact, I contribute to the whole of creation, I would love to be a creekside tree growing in fertile earth. But my reality is otherwise. I have to recognize and adapt to this, trusting that I do truly have the capacity to adapt. And above all, I think, I can learn to recognize prosperity for what it really is when it comes to this place. Ultimately, something similar happens to Sir Gawain. Remember Sir Gawain, way back at the beginning? He has to reconcile himself to the difficult situation he is in. He has to accept the valley of death, which he must face, seeking out the Green Chapel and the Green Knight. At last, when he comes to the Green Knight, Gawain gives himself up for lost. He kneels before him and bares his neck. The Green Knight swings the axe up and then down, but the blade only grazes his skin, just the slightest nick. Gawain's life is spared because of his faithfulness. For myself, I'm going to claim faithfulness in the midst of the strange wilderness where I find myself. I think faithfulness is one of those peculiar evolutionary superpowers which have accrued to humans over the long haul of time, similar to those which sustain cacti and other plants in the desert. I think it is available to all of us, more than available. I think it is coursing in our blood and in our brains, quietly coaching us in that mantra, there is no separation. I need the forest, and the forest needs me. I need the divine, and the divine needs me. There is no separation. From my own wasteland, I claim that faithfulness for all of us. There is no separation. God comes to us as a baby in the same helpless manner that we all arrive in the world, because we are needed by the divine for sustenance, for shepherding, for love. This is the mystery of Epiphany that has been rippling out ever since. Slow down, pay attention, know the land we inhabit. These are the deeply inherited gifts of faithfulness endowed to us all. Slow down, pay attention, know the land we inhabit, and we will see the kingdom of God flourish into full glory.